Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Rated G Radio. We've got an exciting week of new programming for you. I'm going to give out some shout-outs in just a real quick second, but I want to let you know that for the rest of the week, you can set your radio dial, as it is such, on the computer here for fun programming the rest of the week. Tomorrow night we have an author from New York City, Rafi Hazi. I'm probably saying his name wrong. He phonetically spelled it for me, but I don't have it in front of me. But Rafi's going to be on talking about his thriller book called The Next on Tuesday's show. Wednesday, we've got Rebecca Fesk returning to the show at an early start time at 5 p.m. So if you're wanting to call to ask your questions, you can line up early. Again, anytime Rebecca's on the show, the phone lines open up 15 minutes before the show starts. I'm giving you a secret because the Wednesday callers tend to gravitate towards Rebecca's program. So if you have always been curious about trying to get a question answered by Rebecca, call in 15 minutes early. Thursday, we've got another author out of upstate New York. I don't know what's going on with New York, but they're exploding with folks. And we are going to have Mason Stokes on the line, and his book is called Saving Julian. And then Friday night, we've got a new young singing sensation that is probably going to be the next, I want to say Justin Bieber, but nobody likes Justin Bieber anymore. How about like Bruno Mars or somebody like that where, you know, he's really cool, hip, and sings great songs. Mr. Mikey Wax is going to be joining our show as the VIP special guest star on the Friday Night Dance Party. That's going to be an hour one at the normal time of 7 p.m. And you're saying, it's always 7 p.m. It's not always 7 p.m. It just depends upon where the guest is calling from. For example, this past Friday, we had French on Friday, the Austrian singing group, calling in live from Vienna, Austria. The first time we've had an Austrian guest on the show was this past Friday. They have a fantastic rendition of George Michael's Careless Whisper. And you can hear all about that because Elizabeth called in from French on Friday, and we did that show at 9 a.m. So with that being said, we've got some exciting things happening in this world as well, and that's going to start tonight with Athena Murphy, who is a I don't even know how to describe her because she is just like this white, shining light of bright energy and creativity, and she does so much in this world. But specifically for this show, we're bringing her on because she's an amazing singing coach, and she's a motivator and does a bunch of other things. So this is going to be like part one of a 55-part series we're going to do with her. But at least to get started, we're going to say welcome Athena to the show. So Athena, how are you tonight?
Oh, this 55-part series. I'm so excited. I can't wait.
Well, I'll probably have to clear that with your publicist after this. But, you know, yeah. So it's an honor to have you here. And I need to let everybody know, whenever I have a new guest on the show, I try to give the 6 degrees of separation on how I'm introduced to the guest. Because a lot of you say, how do you get these incredible guests? And, you know, it'd be nice to say, I've got this great team that works behind the scenes that calls all these places around the world. Well, it doesn't happen. I make all the calls and I make all the, you know, the guests show up on the show. But I was introduced to Athena probably about, I'm going to say about 3 months ago by my good friend R.J. Tolson, who was looking to do some vocal exercises. And I was getting ready to do the last, three songs of final vocals on my album. And my singing coach, Bill Sinkay, had taken off. Not because he hated my singing, but Neil Diamond hired him to be his full-time bass player on his world tour. So I was kind of left without a vocal coach for the last couple of months. And, you know, I knew that I needed some additional, you know, superstar training. And RJ says, I've got the person for you. This lady is incredible, and you are totally going to hit it off with her. And I'm like, oh, great. But, you know, I need to not be this doubting Thomas because, you know, RJ has never steered me wrong ever. And so I got a chance to go meet Athena. And the second I walked in the door, I went, this is the lady for me. So selfishly, I will tell you that she worked with me on 3 different songs that I was trying to, you know, stumble my way through and loved the direction and coaching that she gave me to complete the songs. And if I didn't have her help, I'm just going to be honest, the songs would have been horrifically horrible and they actually turned out really, really good, and you're going to love them on the new album, Blonde Jesus, that comes out on June 5th. So for everybody saying, how did you get this superstar singing coach to come on your show? Well, it's because of RJ, and then I actually studied with her, and I said, Athena, would you mind taking an hour out of your day? And she says, oh, you're going to twist my arm that hard, I suppose. So here we are tonight.
Anyway. Here we are, yes.
So how have you been? I haven't seen you for a hot minute.
Yeah, because you've been busy launching this whole album Take Over the World thing, and I've stood back and watched and gone, oh, my God, I'm so lucky to be involved, because it's been really cool to watch all this.
It is. Yeah, it's so much fun. But you have a lot going on in your world. And for everybody who is hearing your voice and your name for the first time tonight, which is a shame because everybody needs to know this lady. And if you ever need vocal coaching, I'm going to tell you, you have to go see her. But can you give the listeners a little bit of your history and background? And because I think one of the things that really stunned me was just how expansive your knowledge base is in bringing everything that you know to exactly your amazing talent.
Thank you. So my background is I started as a performer when I was about 4, 5, 6 in there. I knew at 4 that I wanted to be a performer, and I made my stage debut at 6. And once I started studying music formally, I just never stopped. So I play about 10 different instruments. I sing in 16 languages. I have been teaching it for 21 years, and I teach piano, voice, guitar, and songwriting. And then how I bring a lot of that to bear in some of the multidisciplinary stuff that you experienced was when I was in music school, when I was about 19, I started studying neuroscience with a lot of passion and curiosity and wanted to apply that to music. So anybody who understands neuroscience, you get a musical edge in that things make a lot more sense when you understand how your brain works. But I also have been an athlete my whole life. And so when I studied opera in college, I did it a lot like an athlete. I really had a very tactile, kinesthetic understanding of how my body worked. And when my teacher was teaching me, my feeling was, if I can take my athletic prowess and apply it to what she's giving me technique-wise, everything's going to be easier. And throughout music school, it kind of didn't matter what the instrument was, piano, voice, whatever. I always applied this really multidisciplinary approach to everything. So I've been singing my whole life. I've been playing piano for a bazillion years. And when you came in to work on your stuff, what you got was all of that. And the other thing is I've been doing it all so long that it's really easy for me to just jump from one discipline to another. For me, it's all really seamless. And I'm fascinated by it all. I mean, that's the other really cool thing. There's not a single thing that I do that you interacted with that I'm not utterly fascinated by. I'm just like the total Renaissance chick because I love and am passionate about all these things. But instead of being like kind of, you know, the jack of all trades, master of none, I've picked a couple different things to really zero in on that I get to apply a lot of knowledge to. So it makes me look like I'm really smart at everything. I'm really smart at the stuff I present. Let's put it that way.
Well, then what you present is very well presented because it's like you're a master at this. I want to go back because this I'm so fascinated by your background because there are a lot of people that might do, you know, piano or guitar or voice and maybe two, but probably not three. And so, number one, I think that's very interesting. And you said that you started doing all of this fun stuff when you're like 4 or 5. Did you or your parents know that they had this phenomenal talent on their hands, or was it just kind of, oh, isn't that cute? And then it just kind of blossomed from there. How did that all develop for you?
I knew it. I knew in my gut, and I knew like with this unyielding solidness that I was a musician and there was nothing that was going to prevent me from doing that. My parents tried. They really did not support it. And how this all happened was, as a little tiny kid, I was one of those kids who just sang, you know, from the cradle basically. But I have a sister who's a year older than me who wanted a piano when I was 8 and she was 9. So she asked my parents if they would, you know, could she take piano lessons and would they buy the piano? And they did. Her piano teacher did not start students until they were 9 years old. My best friend down the block took lessons with a different piano teacher. And so my sister, who is a year older than me, and my best friend got to start a year ahead of me. So I'm there in the starting blocks for a year, salivating, waiting for the gun to go off. And when I turned 9, like the first Thursday after my 9th birthday, I had that first piano lesson. And I actually, nobody realized this. I didn't even realize it till I was teaching 4-year-olds as a piano teacher. I had learned to read music by decoding it when I was 4 years old. My parents, this is a really cool story. I hope other people can benefit from this. I was in a family where I was in a church every Sunday from the time I was 5 days old until, you know, whenever. So as a kid, I had grown up around traditional hymn singing, and I knew 400 hymns off the top of my head by the time I was about 4. And it's like that little kid thing where they know the tune, but they garble the words because they don't really know the words. All 9 of us, because there were 9 people in my family, all 9 of us are there in the church pew at one point. And my mom looks down and sees me. So I'm singing my heart out, you know, blah, 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 but whatever the tune was, with these garbled words. And she looks down and notices that I'm holding a hymnal upside down because I haven't learned to read yet. And so she reaches down and she picks up the hymnal and she flips it over the right way in my hand. So I'm now reading, you know, the English print going up and down the way it should. And I can now see what's going on. And I looked down at the page and it was like I cracked the code in that instant. I could follow the dots up and down, left to right across the page, and realized internally, as my voice goes up, the dot goes up. And as my voice goes down, the dot goes down. And I just kept following the bouncing ball across the page for years and had realized by the time, so it was a 5-year gap between the day that happened and my piano lesson started. When I got into piano lessons 5 years later, I learned to read music like in a couple of weeks. It was an astonishingly short time. Yeah. So flash forward years and years and years, and I'm now teaching 4-year-olds. And I just plunged right in and started teaching them to read. And I thought about it, and I was like, well, wait a minute. I learned to read music at 4. There's no reason the little ones can't learn to read it. If I just teach them the same way it happened to me, they'll learn it. And sure enough, I was right. I have had plenty of children that I've taught learn to read music before they could learn to read a language because I had that experience.
Do you think that's also why little kids are able to really quickly and easily and without any preconceived notions like we have as adults, pick up foreign languages? They just would, you know, tackle music in the same manner. It's like, oh, okay, this is just something else that I'm going to learn how to read.
Well, what I've seen in my experience as a teacher is children don't learn faster than adults. Children learn differently than adults. And here's what most adults don't consider. My adult students learn very quickly when I take advantage of their background of a lifetime of listening. Children learn anything fast because they're sponges. Adults learn with a different sort of learning curve, but adults have a lifetime of a stored musical library in their head. So what I do with the adult students is I just take advantage of their lifetime of listening, and then I set them about learning in the most advantageous way. So here's the secret for all of you adults who have been dying to learn music during your adulthood. You don't learn it slower. You learn it at the same pace as the kids, but it looks different. So a lot of adults think that most adults, when I tell them that, it kind of like turns on the light bulb in their head, and they get excited, and they actually learn faster. It's really no different. The age doesn't matter. And here's where the neuroscience comes in. This is why it works. When you take advantage of someone's learning style and then you play to their learning style and you give them the right methodology and the encouragement, they'll learn the same speed as anybody else. It just takes figuring out how does their mouse run through the maze to get the cheese, and then you do that. Yeah, so anybody can learn this stuff as fast as the kids. The thing is, the kids don't have job responsibilities, taxes, they have to do the dishes, that kind of stuff. Children don't have the same schedule as adults. And so children tend to have a different experience of being alive with a different stress level. And when you follow that and you kick into how is this person learning, regardless of what body size they're in, you can get them to learn at the same speed. A lot of it is kids are excited to learn new things, and adults are focused on not screwing up. And so if I just break down those two, if I break down the barriers and then I say to the adult students, wait a minute, you've been hearing this song for your whole life. Let's take advantage of that. Or with the kid, okay, you know, this week your homework assignment is to learn to write your numbers 1 to 10 because it's really hard to learn to write your beats if you don't know how to write your numbers yet. So all those kind of things factor into it. But the little kids and the adults both have the advantage of whatever stage they're in. It's just my job as the teacher to plug into that.
I love it. Go ahead.
That was really with you when you looked at how I applied. Like, I figured out what your learning curve was, and then I applied everything to what was having you succeed the way that we needed you to succeed. So I did. Once I figured out your scheme, I just threw everything at your scheme.
Right, and I think that's one of the things that I really loved, and I think that, you know, everybody can learn something from everybody. But I think that, you know, at some point, and I was talking to somebody about this over the weekend, and I said, it's funny because sometimes, you know, you can have a message given to you at a certain point in your life, but if you're not ready to receive it or not open to it, it's not going to be something that is ever even going to register with you. And I think when we had the chance to visit Athena, my door was open, and I was like, you know, just tell me, you know, tell me what I need to do to, you know, make this work. And, it was really not being afraid of sounding bad or looking silly or doing, you know, exercises that, might make me think twice about what I was doing. But I just did it. And, you know, it was like, oh, okay, if I do what Athena tells me, magically what she says is going to happen happens. That's a concept. So it was just a lot of fun.
But you also bring up a really good point. You did every single thing I asked you to do, and you did it with hunger and commitment and passion and veracity. I wish I could mint that. I wish I could take every single student I've ever taught and have them have that same level of juice, because you really brought it. I gave you the tools, but, man, you stepped in the batter's box and you swung as hard as you could because you wanted the result that badly.
That was it. You know, it was like, I have X number of days and or weeks to get this done. I need some great tools to make this happen. I don't care how silly I look, but I've got to make this happen. You know, and there was a song that you helped me with called Sweat and Testify, and it's a song that if anybody has seen Mad TV, they'll remember Deborah Wilson. She played Whitney Houston and played the Beyoncé characters, and the thing that people forget about her, she's got this amazing, dynamic, fantastic voice, and she came in to do some guest vocals for me, and when we backed that up against my scratch vocals, it was like, oh, Garrett, this is just probably the worst thing that's ever going to happen to you. And I honestly didn't know what was going to happen. And Athena, you were great about, here's what you need to do. And, you know, and you gave me a specific song to go listen to and, you know, go practice with and do these things. And I did, all the things that you said to do and shamelessly. And I said, if I look silly, I look silly. I don't care. I'm doing them. And went into the studio, laid down the vocals for the track, and it came back. And it was ended up being my... I can't really say my favorite song on the album because I like them all, but it's my favorite song on the album now. And I'm like, this is because Athena told me to do A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. So.
yep, exactly. That's one of the cool things about getting, like for me, the opportunity to work on the project the way that I got to with you. One of the biggest barriers that people experience in voice lessons, particularly adults, is this idea of the embarrassment, and it stops people. Now, with you kind of were like, you were uninhibited about it. If I have to squawk like a chicken,
I didn't have a choice. I had to. Yeah.
Right. Because you had a commitment. You had something bigger that you were committed to, and it's like, okay, the price of the commitment I got to be willing to sound like a squawking chicken if that's what gets me the result. Mm-hmm. I've had people who would not do it. I have had people who could not break through that, no matter how much I tried to emotionally make it safe. Because one of the things voice teachers deal with all the time is we got to play therapist a lot. Now, thank God I didn't have to do that with you, because you were just great. But we have to play therapist a lot because people feel so naked and exposed about their singing.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
When I broke through that at 19, it changed my life. Now, that was my teacher Shirley's, you know, genius. And one of the gifts I have, both as a singer and a voice teacher, is now I am 100% uninhibited about my voice. I'll sing anything in front of anybody, and it just doesn't matter anymore. But the tightrope that I walk with a lot of people is the hand-holding to get them to feel okay about whatever is about to crawl out of their mouth. And sometimes if the person's really uninhibited, it's just like, woohoo, they don't care. And that was you, thank God.
Yeah.
But with some people, that can take weeks of work in this emotional zone to get it to the point that they feel safe enough to just make some of the ridiculous noises that you have to make in voice lessons to get better at it. I mean, it's like you got to do some silly stuff to get the body to make the voice sound better. And it was like, that was so not there for you. That was a really delicious part of working with you. It's like you had to get the result, and it didn't matter what the cost was. And so it's like, okay, we're going to link arms, and we're going to walk forward proudly,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to barrel through whatever the stuff is because we got to get the result to show up. And you just went for it. It was great. But I also the benefit for you was I, in the background, knew how to get that stuff done. And that's part of, like, the magic that voice teachers have is we kind of have to know how to take anything and throw it mm-hmm. at it to get the singer to produce the result. But it's also a really fun part of my job.
So is there maybe, like, the top five personalities that you experience with adults and or kids to get them to come out of their shell so they'll open up and let those silly sounds come out?
Yeah, and one of the things that I do, I don't think I had to do it with you because you were already fine with what was going on. But with most people, what I found is if I sound like an idiot first and I do it with abandon and they get to experience me doing all the ridiculous stuff with abandon and no loss of dignity, then it makes it easier for them. But when somebody sees me do it and it still doesn't crack their code, usually it's something about I can't possibly make that sound come out of my mouth, like almost like I'm afraid to embarrass myself that much, even though it's mm-hmm. only her that's hearing it. And then the other one is I'm sort of like I want to believe I'm too good for that, but even that isn't doing it right now. Like it's just so humiliating to imagine myself making that sound that I'm not quite there yet. So and I've had some people, like when we have to do the really silly sounding stuff, anybody's notions of perfection go out the window, which is really what the point is. But sometimes if they just can't imagine emotionally making a sound that ugly come out of their mouth or that ridiculous or that embarrassing, whatever they're calling that particular noise. If they can't imagine it, I may have to do an awful lot of it. And I may have to just kind of look at what's the emotion that crosses their face and see if I can kind of ratchet it down so that the safety, like I have to provide safety and nurturance a lot of the time.
Yes.
And if I, yeah, a huge amount of it. If I make anything safe and I make everything about nurturance, then they can eventually usually get themselves to that point where it's like, it's okay. And there's only been a couple of times in 21 years of teaching over 2,500 students, there's only been two or three times where people honestly could not get to the point that they could break that down. And I threw everything I had at it, and they couldn't get there. The other thing, too, this is – go ahead.
No, please continue. I'm going to save my question as a follow-up.
Okay. the thing, I've had people ask me this question, and I'm probably going to cry as I talk through it because I always do, but I've had people ask me, like, is my voice really, really bad? Like, does it sound okay? Or, like, oh, my God, I mean, it's like, I know I sound really ugly. Do I have hope as a singer? And the thing I always say to people, here come the tears.
Uh-oh.
I have never, ever heard a human voice that at its essence was not beautiful.
Mm.
And I have staked my life on that. I have devoted myself both as a singer and at the piano and pretty much anything musical to every human voice at its essence is beautiful. In its raw humanness, it just is beautiful. And what there is to do is polish it so that the real diamond in the middle of that sound comes out. Because not everybody was born, in fact, 99.9% of us were not born with perfect technique. But the essence of that beauty is there. And my job is to know the body and to know the technique and know the physics and the physiology of sound well enough that I can back end into how do we get the beauty of the sound to be an easy thing to produce. Because my commitment to the singer is everything you sing be easy. And I'd rather that their singing be easy and have my job be hard because that's what they're paying me for. But the rock solid part of it where my commitment is that I have never, ever heard a human voice that at its essence was not beautiful. My job is to get that across.
So my next question for you, Athena, is why do you think it is so painful for some people to get, because I'm telling you, I don't think I'm in that boat now, but before I did the first record, if you said, well, sing, I would have looked at you like you just, you know, you asked me the silliest question in a language I completely didn't understand, one of the 13 languages that you don't sing in, and thought that you were absolutely insane. And now it's like, you want me to sing? Yeah, sure. What do you want me to sing? And I will do it. And I don't know what's happened where my inhibition has been lost, but I think it's easier for people to be naked in a gym shower situation than it is to say, okay, you know, sing a song. And it's so vulnerable for people to be put in a position where they're asked to sing. And, you know, because even in, like, church, how many people are, and I'm going to pretend like I'm singing in church, you're not hearing anything, but I'm moving my lips. Because
right.
They don't want
very
to sing,
common.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah.
You know, why do we, you know, what has happened on a society level that makes us so embarrassed about having music come out of our mouth?
There's two main things that we deal with culturally as in Western culture. The first is we, as singers, attach so much of our identity to the sound of our singing voice, and that equation goes something like, my worth as a human being is the sound of my voice. And you got to crack that nugget and strip that away. And that's a hard one because the second part of the conundrum is, culturally, we put singers on a pedestal. And that's uniquely Western. If you go to Africa, or you go to a lot of indigenous cultures around the globe, you ask people to start singing, and they will just sing. You could be in the middle of the market. You could be in the middle of the town square, and somebody starts singing, and everybody jumps in. In their culture, they don't have this bizarre thing about singer on pedestal. They have singing as a fundamental human right, which is how I own it. But I also want to give that to everybody. I don't care that we're in the West and we have singers on TV and we make it a competition and we make it this big to-do. Singing is a fundamental human right where I stand. And I want to give that to people. I want to give that back to people that it's been taken from because it's painful to go through having that ripped away. And I've had a lot of singers over the years who, you know, they were 6 years old on the playground in kindergarten and somebody laughed at them. And all of a sudden, it's like somebody put a dog collar on them, and it killed off a part of their mm-hmm. their soul and their aliveness. And I'm the equalizer. My job is to give it back. But
and singing is so much fun.
Yes. Yes, it is. And it humanizes us. And if everybody did more of it, we wouldn't have wars. We wouldn't act like jerks. If everybody sang, we'd have a whole lot more fun.
Oh, my goodness. You know, it's such a shame, you know. And now that, you know, I always say my producers unleash the beast, you know, because now it's like, oh, I want to do another song. Or I want, it's like, Garrett, you just need to get the one album done and just do that. And then, you know, we'll work on the next album next year. But you got to go, you know, you got to go promote this one now. And I want to do more. I want to sing more. It's like, you will sing plenty of songs.
Yeah.
Go promote this.
Yeah.
But it is so much fun.
Yeah.
I was telling somebody about a week or two ago, they said, well, you know, what do you get from being a singer? And I said, it's the funnest thing I've ever done in my entire life. I said, I'm not the best singer in the world, and I'll never claim to be, but I have fun doing it. And I want everybody to have fun singing along and doing, you know, participating with me in this process. But because it's like I was so imprisoned for years, oh, I am not going to open my voice. I'm certainly not going to carry a tune. And then now it's like, oh, I want to sing. Let's do this again.
Yes, the imprisoned is such a great word. It's like the American cultural body cast dog collar that everybody gets, you know, shackled in. And you go to something like, you know, you mentioned church or the baseball game. Go to a baseball game and listen to people sing the national anthem. And it's interesting. You start to see who's mouthing it. And it's like a piece of their soul got taken away.
Right.
And right. And then, you know, go 10 seats down and there's the guy who can't carry a tune in a bucket, but he's got his aliveness and boy, is he having a good time. And
yeah.
I'll back that guy up to the end of the earth.
Yeah.
Because he's having that fun experience of aliveness of it. And a lot of the time my goal is to, it's this weird kind of pedestal-like specialness. I'm out to go after that with a 16-pound hammer, you know? I want people to have singing back as a fundamental human right. And what you had all of the right stuff. You just came in with a commitment. You're like, I'm going to do this. And you got back to having fun at it. And now what you can see there is to do is spray it on everyone, because if everyone had more fun at this, oh, my God, would that be
Oh,
great.
My gosh. It would be the best thing ever.
Yes, like I can't wait to be in a club and hear everybody singing Sweat and Testify at the top of their lungs.
I can't
you
either.
You know, like your part, Deborah's part, you just like get in the mosh pit and just go for that song, because that really is the experience that I want everybody to have. It's like, yeah, just like open your mouth and sing high and loud and go for it as hard as you can, because that's a fundamental human right.
I love it. So let me ask you this. We're at about the halfway point of the show here, and we haven't even talked about, you know, how people schedule singing lessons with you or where you like to do business or how you attract fans to at your website or anything like this. What's your preferred method for client acquisition for singing lessons or anything else you want to, you know, promote?
The easiest way to get me right now is through my other business website, which is athena@remarkablecharisma.com. When I'm not teaching music lessons, I teach business owners how to have more charisma. And the easiest way to get me is just that email address, athena@remarkablecharisma.com. That's not a singing website, but it's an easy way to get me. So as far as, like, how do I work this, I have a studio in Anaheim, California, where I teach, which is where you came.
Yep.
I also can teach lessons online, which you did for part of it. So I can teach
on
Skype or FaceTime. Yeah, it's a great – oh, my God, that has opened up the
so
whole planet.
So convenient.
It is.
So,
it really
yeah.
is. It's great. I've had clients in Australia before. I have singing clients right now in pretty much every time zone in the United States. I have a couple people who take guitar lessons online. I do piano lessons online. So any of it can be done online. Skype and FaceTime and any other online means is really great for that. If people want to contact me, you know, the email address, they can catch me on Facebook, Athena Murphy. You can find Remarkable Charisma on Facebook. So there's a couple different ways to get me. The other thing I will say is I've had people say to me, you know, I really love to sing karaoke. I wish I were better at that. I sell a home study course for karaoke singers. So if you're somebody who just wants to sing karaoke, you don't feel like taking voice lessons, but you want to be better at it, I do that too. I also have another course where if people feel like they're tone deaf, I can teach them in a home study course in the privacy of their own web browser how to get rid of what they perceive as the tone deafness, because I promise it's not tone deafness. But there's an easy way to get yourself out of that. People can find me.
I have just found your Remarkable Charisma website. I've also found your Remarkable Charisma Facebook fan page, and I'm updating the show page right now as we speak. So I'm talking a little slow because I'm doing 14 things at the same time. And I will tell you that if you are looking at the show and refresh your browser, it will actually show Athena's website and the Facebook fan page. So if you are listening on Westar Radio or Chat and Spin Radio in the United Kingdom today and you're on your drive time home, I apologize because you don't have the benefit of having that screen in front of you. So it's remarkablecharisma.com. And then, of course, on Facebook, it's facebook.com/remarkablecharisma. You can like the page and then stay in touch with Athena on that. What a great way for people to be in communication with you. And I love your Remarkable Charisma website. And honestly, I don't think we've talked about that before. I like it because it's clean and simple.
Yeah.
It's not full of clutter and like, oh my gosh, this makes my eyes hurt to take a look at this. So
yeah,
I don't want to stop talking about singing, but maybe do you want to talk a little bit about Remarkable Charisma and the things that you do with that business, or should we save that for another time? I'm totally game because you're coming back.
Yeah, we can save that for another time. We can do another show on the charisma piece. That's got 400 different fascinating stories associated with it too.
Okay, well, cool. So because I don't want to lose the opportunity to talk about that at all. So where I found you through a referral. How do people normally end up sourcing you to be a singing coach? Because I think, you know, at least we live in Los Angeles, or, you know, we live in Orange County, but, you know, the Southern California area, and we have people all over the country and all over the world who listen to the show. And at least here in Southern California, I think you could throw a rock and hit a singing coach or somebody like that. How do you distinguish what you do and draw clients to you that separates you from maybe, you know, the other 500,000 people that are, you know, claiming to be vocal coaches out there? Because I'm telling you, you're the real deal, Athena. I know what some of the other vocal coaches do, because I don't want to say hear horror stories, but you hear horror stories about having, you know, you go in for 6 weeks and you pay $1 million a lesson and you get to rehearse scales. And that's not you. How do you do what you do from a business standpoint?
From the business standpoint, usually, just like, you know, RJ referred you to me, somebody finds me through somebody. And a lot of the time, people either will have known a student of mine or heard me sing somewhere, or, you know, see me play the piano or heard that I taught their kid or whatever. They knew me through, you know, some kind of networking thing, whatever. They hear that I teach voice lessons, and they're like, oh, well, I got an 11-year-old that I think really needs you. So a lot of it's referral-based. How I differentiate myself, I am the savior of broken voices. And you're right in that there are a lot of people that call themselves singing teachers, but they have no anatomical technical background in it. I have a dyed-in-the-wool, university-earned anatomical technical background. If you ask me to explain something about the vocal folds and how air pressure works within the diaphragm and how, you know, the air pressure coming through the pipe is supposed to work, I can explain it down to a boring degree of exactitude. When I studied singing, if you heard my musical grandparentage, it would make your head spin. My voice teacher's teacher sang at the Met. And I come from a lineage that's just unbelievable. On piano, Leon Fleischer was my teacher, Greg's teacher. So it's like when I start talking about, like, another one of my teachers studied with Rosa Poncel. You know, so it's like Rosa Poncel, Rose Bampton, Leon Fleischer. I got it in my quiver. And when I started teaching singing lessons, what I kept finding was I was inheriting students from other teachers who just kind of taught scales and said dumb things like breathe from the diaphragm, but they never really teach anybody how to do it. So I got lucky. My teachers also were the teachers of, you know, they fixed broken voices. I come from a lineage of teachers who inherited students that had nodules and broken voices and dropouts in their range where they couldn't get sound out at all and, you know, all sorts of problems. And it was just these people would find their way to us, and we had to fix what the problem was. Well, if you know the technical end of it really, really well, it's, I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's not difficult to fix a voice that isn't working properly. All you have to do is get it back to get the air, get the aim, get the relaxation, and get it so everything you're doing is easy. And once you know the recipe, air, aim, and relaxation, it really is all easy to do once you get that down. You got to put the work in, and that's the difference. I come from a lineage of you earn that voice. If you're world class, if you're good at what you do, it's because you earned that sucker. But it's once you learn what's going on with technique, technique saves everything. It is the great equalizer of singing. If you got great technique, you're going to be a fantastic singer. That's just how the body works. But it's knowing the technique in the safest, healthiest way. That's the trick. I just got blessed in that I got a phenomenal voice teacher the first time around, and then I knew what to look for after that. So all three of my voice teachers have been astoundingly astute at their craft, and I'm truly blessed to have had every one of them. And they gifted to me what that was, and now I'm super educated at it. When I work with somebody, my commitment is you will be safe at this.
Well, and that is one thing that I really appreciate you sharing with me, because again, you know, walking in to you the first time, you know, I don't know anything about you except that you got a AAA rating or a 5-star rating or an R.J. Tolson rating, whatever you want to call it, and that was good enough for me. And walking in, but immediately, you know, you just made me feel very safe, very comfortable in the space that we were in, and that, you know, when it came time for me to open up my mouth and let sound come out that wasn't me talking, I was like, I'm comfortable around this woman, and I trust the things that she's telling me to be true, and that's going to allow me to, you know, be a whole lot more open than anything else. And so I really respect that out of just how your teaching method, and I think that just speaks volumes for the, you know, what, 2,500 people that you've tutored over the years and continued to work with. I have so much I want to ask you. I'm like looking at the clock. Like, we're never going to get it all in tonight, which is totally fine because we're going to have you back. But do you have, for people who are listening tonight who are going like, well, you know, she talks a good game, but she's never heard me sing before. So for just, you know, the Joe and Sally Schmoes of the world who are listening in tonight, do you have maybe one or two tips or tricks that you could give them as they start to sing in the shower tomorrow morning that they could start practicing?
Yes, and I got two right off the top, so here they are.
Cool.
If you suspect that you're tone deaf, which a lot of people do, here's the question. Here's how you know whether or not you are. Can you tell the difference in the melody lines between Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and Mary Had a Little Lamb? If you can, if you can hear the difference in those two melody lines, you are not tone deaf. Yay! Thunderous applause all over the planet. Millions of people have now been saved from tone deafness. If you can hear a melody line, the bottom line fact is, if you can hear a melody line and distinguish it from any other melody line, you're not tone deaf. Now, that's in the brain on the way in. How do we affect the sound coming out? What I would say to all my shower singers out there is, try this for a week. Lick the back of your front teeth. Feel where your upper front teeth are. And just practice aiming all of your sound straight at your front teeth. So you're singing into the hard surface of your upper front teeth. If you do that for a week, what you're going to start to notice about 4 or 5 days into that, if you just remember to do it, you're going to start to notice that there's less pressure and strain on your throat. So what that means is the physical act of singing will get easier if you do nothing but aim at your teeth. Because what it does is it gets the voice moving forward in the mouth and in the face, and when you aim at a hard surface, it creates resonance. So how singers do what they do is we aim our voice at hard surfaces along the front of our body. So if you just practice aiming at your teeth, like sing everything like do, 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 right into your front teeth, after about 4 or 5 days, it's going to get easier to do. So there you go. Those are the $2,000 pieces of coaching up front.
I love it. Okay, so the bill, everybody, she's sending you a bill in mail. So
there you go.
With those two tips, are there things that people typically do that are not necessarily beneficial to their voice? And that could be, you know, from diet and exercise, or, you know, things they're, you know, putting into their mouths or things like that. Are there things that you see regularly that people do outside of having sound come out that don't necessarily serve them well?
Yes, the top three things, and anybody can fix these in 5 minutes or less. Number one thing that people do that causes them, you know, hardship is they try to sound like another singer. So they imitate another singer. The number one thing that people bring with them walking in the door is, I want to sound like fill in the blank. It's actually injurious to you to imitate another singer. So if I try to sound like Lauryn Hill or Mary J. Blige, I don't have their DNA code. I have my DNA code. I can use their vocal stylings and sort of put their phrasing on my innate singing, and that's safe. But if I imitate their sound, that's unsafe, and it causes an undue amount of strain on the throat. So everybody quit doing it. Item number one. Item number two. Most people forget to breathe. the number two way to make it easier is inhale before you sing. Don't wait until you're out of air to take another breath. Take the breath before you start singing. If you just tank up and get air in before you make noise, it's automatically going to get easier. And then what was the number three thing? It was brilliant before I forgot it. I had this. It was gonna create world peace and save humanity. What the heck was it? People, number three, stop singing so hard and so loud. Quit over singing. Your voice is fabulous just the way it is. Most people, because again, it's this westernized thing of we put singers on a pedestal and we splash them all over TV. If you grew up watching a lot of this really athletic over singing with singers thrashing themselves around on stage, making it look hard, your instinct is going to be, well, I have to do that, or it mean I, it doesn't, it, like I'm not singing if I'm not doing all the histrionics and scenery chewing. No. Over singing is actually damaging to the voice and takes all the fun out of it. Quit over singing so hard. You'll have way more fun.
I agree.
Those are the three.
That is huge. Now, out of all the years that you've been teaching and the thousands of people that have come through your doors for your vocal lessons, piano lessons, guitar lessons, do you have any fun examples of students that you've worked with, maybe young or old, that you can share with us that were just kind of like maybe, you know, a tear in the eye moment? It's like, I can't believe that was my student type of a thing, or maybe funny things that have happened to you while you've been teaching?
Let me think. I have a famous person who studied with me whom I don't have clearance from them because I never went back to ask to use their name. But early in my career, I did have somebody who had a platinum recording, and that was one of those like, wow, that was a heck of an experience to teach that person. So that was somebody who walked in the door with a heck of a lot of talent and wound up with a number one hit. And it was like, wow, that really does happen to people. So that was a cool one. Like, I can tell the story. That was kind of cool. But the ones that really, like, if I think about who are the ones where I, you know, they just made me cry, a lot of it was seeing the kids who never thought that they would be particularly good, who turned out amazing. And, you know, you take somebody who's afraid to sing in the beginning, and you put them through a couple of months of lessons, and Mariah Carey's coming out of their mouth, and they're as shocked as, like, they can't believe it. You know, they're turning around looking, going, who, me? I remember the first couple of times that I had, like, you know, the middle school girls, like, they're about to, you know, they're going through puberty, and their body's exploding, and they feel uncomfortable, and they're all awkward, and all of a sudden, they, like, they hit a high C, or they sing a Mariah Carey song, and they're just blown away that they could do it. I've had kids make me cry in those situations, and I've had it happen enough times that I know it's predictable and I know it's doable. I know that over here as the expert. But there is nothing like the moment of watching that happen in front of you, where somebody has no idea that it's possible to sound as good or better than the famous person. And those are the moments. I remember the first time it happened to me. I remember the first time that I heard myself do things where I'm like, oh, my God, I waited 12 years for that sound to come out of my mouth.
Oh, wow.
And it did. Yeah, yeah. But then to turn around and be in the teacher standpoint and have it happen with a kid who it's all they want in the world is to be a good singer. And they're not good. They're great. And the moments where they've made me cry, it's like, oh, my God, you can't. Like, nothing can touch this moment. To hear the kid do the thing and just go, like, you know, tears are rolling. And I've had that happen enough times that it's like, yeah, this is the part of the job where, you know, that's the cake. That's the best of it.
I love hearing it. You know, because it's so, you know, it's fun when you go hear a Mariah Carey or a whoever, you know, just using that as an example.
Yeah.
But isn't that just so incredible? And it's all, I would almost think it's almost kind of selfish going, you know, I help, you know, little Susie sound like Mariah Carey, but, you know, you kind of help develop that talent along the way and you help unlock the chains of whatever's been, you know, holding that back. And then, you know, little Susie sings Vision of Love or whatever it is by Mariah Carey. And you're like, holy cow, I helped that along a little bit. Do you, I mean, you must be very proud of your students as they, you know, go through. Do you, and I should ask you this, because this is a silly question for me to ask, but do you do any type of, like, graduation, or do they take singing lessons till, you know, they said, okay, I'm going to go record my number one album, I'll see you later?
I have had some of that. I mean, I've had people audition for The Voice and American Idol, and they didn't get on, but they've done the audition. And I've prepared a lot of people for those auditions. I have a couple people now. Like, I have a young lady who's just phenomenally good. I mean, she's good in capital letters beyond what, I mean, it's just shocking how good she is. She's 13 or 14, and she's doing this with the intent of recording an album. And I've also had a couple of them like that. Yeah. And so to get up underneath one of those kids is a really fun thing to do. But the thing that gets me every time is I get the person, and that doesn't really matter what their age is. It's that the passion is there, and I hear them do the thing that they have just been dying to do for years. And we put them in the lessons for a couple months or a year or so, however long it takes, but they sing that thing that shocked them. And I go back to the moments where I was incredibly blessed to work with some of the most gifted singers in L.A., not just the three teachers I've had, but I've been really lucky. I sing pop and gospel, but where I really cut my teeth is sacred and classical. So I do, like, the, you know, like the Mozart stuff and all of that. I've worked with singers that are just phenomenal and make me cry every time. And I think about how blessed I was for 15 years of singing with them as colleagues. I mean, for me to get to call myself a colleague of some of the people I've sung with, the honor that grants me is beyond what I can put into words. And when I think about the blessing it was to sing with them, I look back on some of the moments where they made me cry with their sound. And it's almost like, I'm not the only person who taught this kid. Those people who taught me taught this kid. It's like, I think when you get it why singing is timeless, and when you get it why the perfect note has everybody's hair stand on end, when you get at that moment where why a particular song or recording makes you cry every time and you still don't know the why, you just know it does, that's where it's like there's a timelessness to this. And there's, you know, I teach the same technique that, you know, Mozart singers were doing. If you've seen the movie Amadeus, and you watch some of the opera singers in the movie Amadeus, and you hear what they were doing, and it's like you put yourself back into what bel canto singing is really about. That's the technique I teach. There's a timelessness to that that is astounding and riveting and moving every time I connect with it. So it's not just me teaching the kid. It's that lineage and it's that history that walks in the room with me. I just get to be lucky enough to have those moments where the kid makes me cry. And I don't know any singing teacher who doesn't bring that in the door if they really, you know, it's like I'm blessed enough to have the technique I have. And I'm blessed enough to have been around the people who shared it with me. And I don't know any of us who don't bring that to bear every time we work with a student, especially when we see a student hit it out of the park because they did what we asked them to do. They did the homework. They did the practice. They put in a mind-numbing amount of work on scales that other people found boring. They earned that voice. And then I get to hear them do that. It's like, oh, my God, there's nothing better than this.
I love that story. And as we're running out of time, I have one other question that I want to ask you about tonight, and then I'm going to really do two questions. But the first question is, when we started working together, you shared with me some of your experience in singing the classical music. And,
yeah,
you know, as just, you know, some guy off the street, I didn't ever once give any thought to people actually singing classical music. Can you tell me about your experience singing that and why you find that such an impactful influence on how you even teach today?
Yeah, I started as a pop singer as a kid. I'm one of those kids who sang every song on the radio. And when I got so I started classical music first as a piano player, but when I was a kid, remember, my experience was coming up in the church, and so I was a hymn singer. So I was singing hymns, and I knew every song on the radio. So when I got into closer to my adulthood, I started real choral singing, like you're in an adult choral group, when I was 16. And that's when I started getting exposed to actually singing classical music. But I started studying opera as a technique when I was 19. And there was something about, like, when I got to learn the habanera from Carmen, and when I started studying Carmen as a role, or I got to sing Mozart, and I started learning Mozart songs, there was something about that that was just like, this is the Olympic athlete coming out of me. This is the get up every morning and run the laps on the track. You really earn your stripes when you can sing Mozart, or you can sing Beethoven, or you can sing any of the classical music composers whose names are still around. And when you do it in a choral setting, I mean, some of the real jewels of vocal music are not on an opera stage. They're in classical choral music written for the church. Just heart-stoppingly beautiful music in the choral tradition from the 1400s up to the present. And I cut my teeth and I earned my stripes studying that work. I'm a musician and an athlete down to my bones. And so when I look at a Nadia Comaneci or Sugar Ray Leonard or a Michael Phelps or any athlete who has gained, I mean, Bruce Lee is one of my heroes. You would never think that I would apply Bruce Lee to singing lessons, but I do.
Okay.
I am the Jeet Kune Do of singing. That's
wow.
The essence of what I do. And I am dedicated to mastery. It doesn't matter if it's running or weightlifting or singing or piano or songwriting. I am the Jeet Kune Do of the deal. So classical music, opera and sacred, and spirituals too, because I study spirituals a lot. When you get the essence of that work into your bones and into your body, and you can do it on a dime. Somebody could come in and wake me up at 2 a.m. and I could sing Carmen to them. When you get the technique at that level, it makes you bulletproof. And that, I mean, when you're bulletproof, you can walk on stage at any moment and you can really knock it out of the park. And that was what I was after for all those years. I pretty much, it's not that every day is a great singing day, but I don't have a bad performance.
Yeah.
Because my technique means that much to me. So if you need me to sing, great. I am there with bells on. I am prepared, and I'm going to knock it out of the park because I own it to that level. That's the Jeet Kune Do. And classical music tends to attract those of us who are willing to wear it that way. It's kind of like it takes the – you got to have your inner zealot really lined up to do that. But, man, when you earn the right to sing classical music the way that it was meant to be done, it's like it builds a character that is unique to that thing.
And with that, everybody, Athena Murphy has been our VIP special guest star tonight. You have to go check out her website. If you're looking on the Blog Talk Rated G radio page, I've included two links. Refresh your browser. They'll pop up for you for Athena's website and also her Facebook fan page. If you're interested in taking singing lessons, you don't have to be in Southern California. As she said, she can do the lessons over Skype or FaceTime. But if you get a chance to see her in person, it is well worth the experience because you will find none better. Athena, our time's done tonight, but I would love to have you back. And so we'll chat offline to figure out dates that we can bring you back in the future. Everybody, don't drive distracted. We're going to be live tomorrow night with New York's author Rafi Hazy and his book, The Next. Thank you, Athena. We got to go. We'll see everybody on Tuesday night.
You've been listening
to
Rated G Radio.
Thank you.